Hi, this is Tiffany. I just wanted to drop in to our podcast today and acknowledge COVID-19. The Digital to Learn podcast has pre-recorded episodes, and we do plan to continue on with those during this time. But we also just want to stop and acknowledge everything that you're going through and let you know that we're all in this together. And we hope that now more than ever, you find our content about digital learning relevant and useful in your daily lives. Everybody stay safe, and we wish you some happy listening.
So we have a problem with the tradition that we come from, in that higher education was designed to be a fairly elitist, rarefied experience for the well-heeled, anointed, and well-apportioned folks of our society. And the people that work within higher education are really mostly focused on research and publication. We haven't envisioned higher education as being a place that is for everyone, and that the folks that work in higher education are fundamentally driven by a passion for high-quality teaching and learning.
The Digital to Learn podcast is dedicated to exploring both what's new and what's good in the use of technology in teaching and learning.
Our mission is to have the best minds sitting in front of our microphones sharing evidence-based strategies for digital teaching and learning.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
Thank you for joining us. And now, the Digital to Learn podcast.
Welcome to the Digital to Learn podcast. I'm Tiffany, and I'm here with my co-host, Brad Garner. Hi, Brad.
Hello, hello.
We are so excited to welcome Peter Campbell to the Digital to Learn podcast. Over the last 25 years, Peter has held a number of positions on both sides of the industry, as a product manager for eLearn.com, as the director of academic technology at Montclair State University, as a regional director of sales for Blackboard, as the director of immersive learning strategy for Pearson, and now as a regional director of sales for Instructure. We are excited to welcome Peter Campbell to the Digital to Learn podcast. Welcome, Peter.
Hello, hello.
We reached out to Peter to ask him to be a guest on the podcast because he is recognized as a leading innovator and evangelist for the transformative use of educational technology. Today, we have an opportunity to hear more about his journey and his career insights as they apply to the world of digital teaching and learning. So we're going to dive right in.
Sounds great.
And of course, we're going to start with the fun questions. So Peter, can you tell us bungee jumping or rock climbing?
Well, I would never for a moment, not even for a microsecond, ever consider bungee jumping, not even for a nanosecond. So that's establish the baseline there. Rock climbing, I would love to rock climb. I have actually tried rock climbing in a bouldering gym, but I was mercilessly inept at it. So I would have to say neither, unfortunately. If I were smaller and lighter and stronger, I would say rock climbing, but I am none of the above, so woe is me.
Probably an excellent choice.
Thank you.
Okay, let's turn to the exciting world of pizza.
Yes.
Deep dish, pan, or thin crust?
Oh, thin for sure, and actually gluten-free thin, although I'm not gluten-free, I'm not a gluten-averse person for whatever reason. I don't know why, but thin gluten-free pizza crust is amazingly good, so thin gluten-free every time.
Have you tried the cauliflower pizza
crust? I
have
not. I have heard all the cool kids now are eating cauliflower crust. So I aspire to be a cool kid and eat cauliflower crust.
The cool kids and me.
You. Okay.
SUV or convertible?
Definitely an SUV because I drive one. Although shout out to all my carbon neutral friends out there. I drive a hybrid SUV. It's a RAV4 hybrid. So I get some points in heaven for not completely contaminating the environment.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I almost made the question about whether or not that was of concern to you. So I'm glad you added that.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
So would you rather eat no candy at Halloween or no turkey at Thanksgiving?
I actually detest candy. Just most forms of candy are loathsome to me, with the exception of chocolate. Now, chocolate, I will eat chocolate all times of the day, every day. Stranded on a desert island kind of thing, I'd have chocolate for sure. So, but I don't consider chocolate to be candy. I was a vegetarian for several years and have only recently turned back. I would say I'm officially now meat curious. So, but I've gone back. I actually had turkey this year for Thanksgiving for the first time in like, I don't know, 10 years. So I'd have to go.
Wow.
I could easily give up candy. I could have gone given up turkey for a while, but I think no longer. I think my vegetarian days perhaps are now over, at least for now. Stay tuned.
So has the candy thing been a lifelong preference for you not to eat candy?
No, I think it was, you know, like a lot of children, I ate a fair amount of candy. But when I conjure the image, here are the two pieces of candy that caused me to have nightmares.
Okay, oh, ready? No.
Candy corn, which is
low. Love it. I love it.
Low.
Go ahead.
Sun. And the worst thing of all,
it's a vegetable.
The worst thing of all, circus peanuts.
I love those too.
No. Oh. Okay, well, I'm going to hang up right now because
thanks for being with us on the podcast.
I can't talk to you anymore. No, I can't do this.
Oh, no. Yeah.
So Tiffany will ask the rest of the questions.
Yeah, I was going to say, I can't decide if we picked the best or worst intro questions for you. I'm so sorry.
Those are delicacies.
Oh, well.
Okay. Would you rather have Google at your access in your brain or be able to delete anything you wish on Wikipedia?
Oh, definitely the former. Google access in my brain. I mean, let's face it, all of us in 2020, because it's now 2020, we already do that. We've got these little things called smartphones, and they are already adjuncts to our brain, both in terms of our memory as well as our ability to find out information. So there's this whole idea of the convergence between human and machine. That happened years ago. That happened in 2007. We've been there. We've done that.
Yeah.
So if we can make that even more efficient, I'm all in. I'm 100% in.
Would you rather be able to reverse one decision you made every day or be able to stop time for 10 minutes every day?
I think I'd rather go with the latter, just because, you know, I tend not to make decisions that I regret. I might be in a small subset of people, but I don't regret a lot of things that I do. In fact, I don't really have much regret at all. And so I wouldn't want to delete stuff because, you know, you make mistakes and you learn from those and you carry on. But freezing time, that might be kind of cool. I don't know exactly why. I don't know what I would do with that superpower, but you can give it to me. And then it'd be fun to figure out like, ooh, I could stop time right now and do something fun.
Well, after you've done that for a while, we'll have you back on the show.
Yeah, okay.
You can tell us
about it. what I learned. That'd be great.
What came to mind for me was maybe self-regulating emotion. So you're in that meeting and you're about to lose it and you go ahead and push pause and give yourself a little 10-minute break, a little breather, back in smiling and happy.
Yeah. That would be good.
Yeah.
Yeah, well done. Okay, I'll take that one.
Okay. Well, we used those questions to get to know you a little bit better, but what we'd like to do next is just hear a brief overview of your professional journey and how you got to where you are today.
Yeah, my goodness, this could probably take the whole time we're together, but I'll try and give you the highlights. So I started in education back in 1987 when I was an SAT test prep teacher. So I was basically teaching rich white kids how to ace the verbal section of the SAT. And I discovered that I was pretty good at teaching. I had a background in acting, so I was used to standing up in front of audiences and commanding their attention, at least trying to command their attention. But the difference, of course, between a classroom and a theater audience can at any point get up and walk out if they don't like what you're doing. In a classroom, they can't do that because you can give them something called an F. So I had a captive audience. And taught face-to-face for quite some time, a number of years, and got really passionate about education and teaching, and it became my calling. And then there's this thing that happened back in 1995 that you may have heard about called the internet. And technically, the internet has been around. I mean, technically, the internet had been around since the 60s with DARPANET, et cetera. But the web as we know it really came out in 1995 with Netscape and that whole thing. And so there I was as a relatively new, passionate, young, hungry educator, teacher, and this thing called the web came along and I got really hooked. I thought about all the different capabilities that I dreamed of as a classroom educator and began to imagine and envision what would be possible using interactive multimedia technology that was not only computer-based but network-based and thinking about multiple learners connecting to each other over the entire planet. So I've been heads down inside EdTech since 1995. So that's 25 years now. So yeah.
25 years.
My goodness. I can actually do the math. But I've been doing that for 25 years now. And I've taken on lots of different forms inside of that big sort of context, that bucket. So I worked as an adjunct for a while, teaching students how to use digital technologies when I worked at the University of Missouri in Columbia, and got really into multimedia development. Then fast forward to the late 90s, where I became a product manager for a startup in New York City called eLearn.com. And we were trying to build something. Now get this, this was 1999, right? We were trying to build something called a learning management system. Now in 1999, that was pretty cool because no one knew what the hell that was, right? And we, my job was to basically build a learning management system from scratch, focused on the K-12 market. And we were trying to make it easier for teachers to integrate standards into their lesson plan. So we came up with this product that was essentially this interactive lesson planner that had access to all 50 states standards, and you could integrate those and track those. So that was all exciting and good. And then the bubble burst early 2000s, and that company went belly up. I got out just in time and joined the staff at Montclair State University. And I was there for 10 years and had a number of different roles. I was an instructional designer, but was also the director of academic technology there for a couple of years. And I got to see firsthand what it was like to be part of an institution, about what it was like to drive technology and adoption. Went through a couple different learning management system evaluations. So when I first joined, the campus was on WebCT. I don't know if your listeners or y'all are familiar with WebCT, but anyway, WebCT was a big player back in the late 90s, early 2000s. And then there was this young startup company called Blackboard. And Blackboard was a cool new kid on the block back in the early 2000s. So we took WebCT out and put Blackboard in. And I was responsible for doing that implementation and leading the training and the faculty development piece. And then fast forward many years later, and Montclair State decided to leave Blackboard behind and actually move to Canvas, where I am today. That's my current position is with Instructure selling Canvas. But in between that time, I left Montclair State in 2011 and actually went to work for Blackboard. Worked as initially as someone who was focused on web conferencing, real-time synchronous communication. I'd done quite a lot of work at Montclair State, focusing not so much on the asynchronous learning design, but more on the synchronous piece. Since there was not a lot of expertise or a lot of best practices, I was excited to carve out new territory and innovate inside that space. So focusing on synchronous, went over to Blackboard, focused on Collaborate, is the name of the tool that you and your listeners may know of. But of course, Collaborate was an invention brought together when Wimba Classroom and Illuminate were acquired by Blackboard and brought together in kind of a shotgun marriage in 2011, 2012. And the two products came together and became Collaborate. So I focused on that and then got into directly sales for Blackboard and was selling Blackboard products, and then moved into a strategy role at Blackboard, where I was responsible for helping lead some initiatives around go-to-market strategies for various other products and services. Then left Blackboard in 2015 and went to Pearson, and I got to work at Pearson for just over a year. And the Pearson journey was super exciting because that's where I started to get into this whole immersive learning thing. So virtual reality, augmented reality, mixed reality, and got to do some exciting work with Microsoft in particular, where we were working on their HoloLens device. I don't know. Have y'all heard of the HoloLens? Do you know what this device is?
No.
Okay. No.
All right. Well, you and your listeners should definitely check out HoloLens. So it's H-O-L-O, holo, like hologram, holograph, and lens, L-E-N-S, like the lenses in your glasses. But HoloLens is basically a computer that you wear on your head. And instead of having a display like you would with a computer, the display comes over your eyes. So it kind of looks like a fancy pair of super high-tech ski goggles. But basically, when you look out through the device and you see into your field of view where you're looking, you can see holograms. And depending on the quality of the holograms, some of them actually look really, really real. So much so that you would mistake the thing that's in the space as a fully three-dimensional object. And so the project that I led at Pearson was trying to solve problems around nursing education. And so we developed an application called HoloPatient. And I'm proud to say HoloPatient is actually in the market today for sale. So you and your listeners can Google HoloPatient and check it out. I'm biased because I was the project lead, so I think it's pretty cool. But it's pretty stunning. Yeah, and it's stunning in terms of the fidelity and quality of the holograms. Basically, in a nutshell, it's these we filmed real people in 3D volumetric video capture. So basically, you turn a person into a 3D hologram, and you can walk around this person, and they look real, but they're not real, right? They're obviously a hologram. But what we did was we designed this application to simulate patients that were going through various phases of distress. So in the research that I did for this market, it was clear that the nursing students who were training needed to be aware of these things that we call high-risk, low-frequency incidents. So there were very risky incidents, like someone having an anaphylactic drug reaction, right? So they take some medicine, and all of a sudden their body goes south, and they start having hives and itches, and they can't breathe very well. That's a very high-risk incident, but it's low-frequency, and that it doesn't happen very often. But as a nursing student, if you're training for these things, you better darn sure be ready to spot something like that when it occurs, so that if it does occur, you know instantly what to do. So the whole idea was to create a set of volumetric video experiences for nursing students to be able to spot these high-risk incidents and then be able to train and know what to do, how to recognize them, and then what to do when you saw them. So that was essentially what the product was designed to do. Yeah, and like I said, it's out today. And it's one of the nice things about being in product management, product development is a lot of products go by the wayside. They don't ever get out of the idea phase, but we got it out of the idea phase and into the market. So yeah, so that was that piece. And then I left Pearson and started my own company. So I was so excited about virtual reality and immersive learning that I formed my own company called Experial and was the CEO and founder of Experial and did that for a couple of years. And then that was and still is an exciting project. I think it's still too early, quite honestly, for the education market in particular, in that I think it's clear that, at least for me, that it's not a question of if this will take off. I just think it's a question of when. And that when is largely determined by the fact that the hardware that's used in this space is still a little bit too expensive, a little bit too technically difficult. And there aren't a ton of applications out there for educational institutions to use to solve real problems. HoloPatient notwithstanding, there aren't a lot of examples of really useful pieces of software that really solve real problems. But that said, I think that's going to change over time. But decided to move out of the immersive learning space and get back into the learning management system space. So I joined Instructure about a year ago and then have been with Instructure, focusing mostly on selling the learning management system Canvas, which I'm sure you and your listeners know about. Mm-hmm. But also excited that with Instructure, as we've matured under our new leadership, we've become more than just a learning management system company. So we're doing some really interesting things around student success and around retention and engagement, which we can talk about later. But that's a very long-winded version of my educational technology journey and my career. So hope that answers your question in a sufficiently engaging manner.
Well, a couple of things popped out at me as you described your journey. One, you tended to be at various points right on the cutting edge of something new. Mm. So the whole learning management system thing, immersive learning, you were there at the beginning of those. And I also am guessing that in your role in sales, you interacted with a large number of institutions. And I'm wondering, kind of blending those two things together, how does that impact your vision of what's going to happen in the future in higher ed?
Yeah, so it's definitely a sense of listening very deeply to what kinds of problems educational institutions are faced with. So being at a single institution, you don't get a ton of opportunities to go outside of your swim lane and interact with other institutions. You can at various conferences and through listservs and through blogs.
But probably only at a surface level.
Yeah, right. Right. And, you know, quite honestly, like, you know, you're not paid to do that, right? You're paid to do your job and you're paid to focus on your institution. And so no offense to my colleagues who are at academic institutions now. And I, as I shared with you, I was one of those people, but we don't get a lot of opportunity to get out of our offices and interact with others. But as you know, working for a software company like Blackboard or Instructure or a big publisher like Pearson, that's your job. I mean, you have to go out and talk to people and find out what's really, what's on their mind. And as a salesperson, you know, salespeople get a bad rep as well. Think of used car salespeople as salespeople. But I really think about myself, this might sound somewhat romantic. I'll admit I'm somewhat of a romantic, but I really think of myself, I describe myself as an evangelist. An evangelist in the root sense of the word is someone who brings good news, right? That's what an evangelist is. Etymologically, a bringer or sharer of good news. And I feel like my job is to stay on the cutting edge, to your point, always been on the cutting edge. But the cutting edge is really about what do we know today based on all the anecdotal evidence, but also all the empirical evidence that we have, the quantitative and qualitative research that's been done. What do we know and how do we leverage all of that information, that knowledge, all those experiences to be able to make a difference and actually help add value and solve problems for the types of problems that institutions are faced. So being out in the field, I get a lot of opportunities to talk to lots of institutions. I have a broad sense of what those problems are. I do stay on the cutting edge, as you mentioned. And so for me, that's just exciting to think about all these different things that people are faced with, to know what I know from their side, to know what I know from the tech side, and to be able to walk into a room of stakeholders who have genuine problems that they need to solve, things that genuinely keep them up at night, things that they see are seemingly intractable problems. These are things that cannot be solved. I get to walk in on a good day, not every day, but on a good day, I get to say, hey, I think I can help you with that problem. And then, yeah, sure, it makes the company money. It makes me money. It's how I make a living. But fundamentally, it's about solving a problem that seemingly before had no solution. And so hopefully, ultimately, the institution benefits, the students benefit, and again, romantically speaking, the world benefits because we have brighter, better students, brighter, better, more engaged teachers who can then do their jobs more efficiently and more effectively. And that makes me feel really empowered, again, being someone who's passionate about education. So that's kind of what that advantage is of being in that sales role.
That's good. So you hear people quite often comment on the level at which change in higher education is so incredibly slow. From your interactions with people at a variety of institutions, what are the things that are holding us back from really embracing change and moving forward?
Oh my, well, here we can get into the third rail conversation, the giant elephant in the room. So, but I'll go there. I kind of like elephants in the room. I don't mind talking about elephants. I kind of like elephants.
All right.
So, you know, I think fundamentally what we have in higher education, certainly in the United States is that we have a problem with the tradition that we come from, in that higher education was designed to be a fairly elitist, rarefied experience for the well-heeled, anointed, and well-apportioned folks of our society. And then inside mm-hmm. of that, and again, no offense to my friends and colleagues who are tenured professors at institutions, but we do have the major focus of most institutions of higher education in this country really being focused towards academic research and publishing, the whole publisher-perish paradigm. And it's really only the institutions of higher education that are focused on learning, i.e. community colleges, where teaching and learning is first and foremost. So because we have a tradition of a combination of these two things, where higher education has historically been really for a very small portion of our society. And the people that work within higher education are really mostly focused on research and publication. We haven't envisioned higher education as being a place that is for everyone, and that the folks that work in higher education are fundamentally driven by a passion for high quality teaching and learning. So those are the historical legacies, the forces that prevent change from happening. But I'm excited to see that is changing. I think that we are definitely at a turning point in higher education. And I think this is largely driven by the consumerization of education, in that students and their parents are becoming more discerning customers. And so we see through the Obama administration, and even now through the Trump administration, more focus and scrutiny on academic institutions actually proving ROI, the return on investment, being able to say, yes, a four-year degree or even a two-year degree, before that seemed just sort of inherently and unquestionably a good thing. But over time, as tuition has increased, as student loan debt has increased, as you all know, more and more attention has been focused on, well, wait a minute, is this whole thing with higher education actually worth it? And as we look even at folks that make it through higher education with a four-year degree, we've got underemployment now being probably the most pernicious problem now. Folks going through amassing large debt, getting these degrees that don't get them jobs. And in fact, they do get jobs that don't require these degrees. So these forces are fundamentally what's causing the slowness to occur. They're hard forces to resist. Like I said, though, I think the good news here is that as institutions are starting to recognize that change is absolutely required, as more institutions are starting to recognize that they need to show the value of their degrees, I think what's fundamentally going to change is that they're going to have to focus on a quality teaching and learning experience, and they're going to have evidence of that. And we will see still some massive resistance towards this trend. And I understand that some folks are concerned that the argument is that we're focused too much on corporate America, that we're focused too much on skills, that we need to train students to be critical thinkers. I don't think we need to throw the baby out with the bathwater, though. I think we can do both. And as we start to do a better job of that, this is where technology really can help out. This is where the learning management system, but other educational systems can really start to make a meaningful difference in terms of helping students attain specific skills that they need for particular jobs, where we can track their progress towards attaining those skills, demonstrating mastery of those skills, and then showing evidence of those skills to employers so that those institutions can now say, hey, we actually know that our education is making a difference. And the way that we know that is we know that our graduates are getting good jobs, jobs with a future. And we know that we're creating skilled workers because we can articulate those skills at a very deep level. And it's not just, you know, widget making or standing in an assembly line. We can do widget making skills and widget making badges, but we can also do critical thinking types of skills. We can also measure collaboration and leadership. These things are all possible. So I think we are, as I said, at an inflection point where that slowness that you referenced, Mike, I think we're going to start to see a big acceleration towards more large scale change. I would say certainly within the next 5 to 10 years. It's already happening now, but just we'll see more of that.
That would be wonderful.
We're thankful for everything that Peter Campbell has shared with us today, and we're excited to announce that there will be a part two coming next week where we can continue the conversation on problems and possibilities in higher ed.
Thank you for joining us on Digital to Learn.
If you enjoyed this podcast, there are three things we ask you to do. One, come back and join us again. Two, tell your friends about us. And three, give us a positive ranking on your favorite podcast platform.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
It's a digital world.
Always keep learning.